Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yeshivat Hadar. I want to begin by just saying a few sentences. I want to begin by not wandering off this screen. I want to begin by saying a few sentences about what we're going to do in the next 3 weeks, and then we'll start doing it. My goal is really to look at four 20th century Jewish thinkers on the question of tefillah, on the question of prayer, and in a sense, about the phenomenology of prayer. That is, this is not a class about liturgy. This is really a class about philosophers and theologians thinking about what's supposed to happen to me when I pray. What, if anything, am I trying to achieve, accomplish through prayer? And in the case of the first two thinkers we're going to be talking about, Abraham Joshua Heschel and Joseph Soloveitchik, we'll do some thinking about the ways in which their vision of tefillah, the ways in which those visions fit into, connect to, a broader theological and spiritual vision, a broader interpretation of what kind of human life Judaism is trying to generate. In other words, what is the role of tefillah in the broader picture of human thriving that they imagine? In the case of the last two thinkers, who we'll consider together during the third session, we'll actually focus much more on specific texts of theirs and think about how we might learn about what we do and don't aspire to in prayer, what we do and don't hold theologically, as a way of perhaps deepening our prayer life and deepening our thinking about prayer. For this week and next, at least, I'm going to start out by talking for a while, and then I'll happily take questions and comments, and we'll hopefully have as freewheeling a discussion as we can. So I'm going to start with Abraham Joshua Heschel tonight, and I'm going to start in a place that will seem dramatically far afield, I think, from the question of prayer. And if you bear with me, I hope you'll see why I'm starting where I am. So if you've ever studied anything about Abraham Joshua Heschel, then you know that his spiritual life, his vision of the religious life, is rooted in and centered on the experience, the commitment to wonder. Wonder is the very basis of the spiritual life, according to Heschel. And I don't want to enter into a long analysis of wonder in Heschel here. If you're interested in that, there are versions of my talks about that available online, where I try to read the first part of God in Search of Man extremely carefully and closely. I don't want to do that tonight. What I want to do, though, is just paint in some very broad strokes what are the aspects of Heschel's theology of wonder that are pertinent to us as we think about the role of prayer in our lives and in his vision of Judaism. So first of all, what is wonder for Heschel? And I think if you were to grope for a simple, straightforward definition of wonder, it is something like a state of perpetual surprise that shades off into perennial gratitude, right? A sense of surprise that there is anything at all, right? For Heschel, the most sort of fundamental question that never goes away for the religiously sensitive person is, why is there something rather than nothing? That's the fundamental question. And in fact, very often when people talk about wonder in Heschel, I think they misrepresent him. Because people often talk about wonder as fundamentally about, I look at something amazing, and I'm moved by it, and filled with a sense of, let's say, radical amazement at it. There are moments in Heschel that are like that, but in fact, as a rule, wonder for Heschel is not about specific things within the world. It's actually kind of a meta-experience, a meta-response to the world itself. It is a response, in his language, to the fact that there are facts at all. That's basically the posture of wonder, is a sense that everything is a surprise. And so for Heschel, the very opposite, as he says on various occasions, the very opposite of a sense of wonder is what he calls taking things for granted. That, by the way, already leaves us with a fundamental question. How do we work on not losing the sense of perpetual newness? And one of the things that Heschel talks about is, these are my words, not his, that routinization is the ultimate poison, right? The fact that I get used to doing the same stuff every day, that I'm constantly in repetitive motion doing the same thing actually cuts against the possibility of my experience in the world as eternally new. I wake up and I know what my day is going to be like. I know what the world's going to be like. And in fact, Heschel argues in one of his, I think, most important sentences about tefillah, although it's not in the context of talking about tefillah, he says, since there is a need for daily wonder, there is a need for daily worship. Right? Since there is a need for daily wonder, there is a need for daily worship. In other words, the goal of tefillah, the first goal, before we even get started with kind of the deeper theology of prayer, the first goal of prayer is to keep our kind of spiritual antenna from dying. From dying amidst the routine, and he would likely add the velocity, the sheer velocity of modernity. Interestingly, by the way, you can already, in the back of your mind, keep in mind something that we're going to come back to, which is, if the goal of liturgy, and if the goal of prayer is to keep wonder alive, it won't surprise you, perhaps, to know that Heschel will spend a great deal of time emphasizing prayers of praise rather than prayers of petition. Because saying the words Rifa'enu, heal me, can elicit a whole variety of feelings, but the first one it elicits may not be wonder. But saying Psukei Dezimra, saying the Psalms of the morning, may in fact do that. And in fact, as I'll get to later, one of the things I think Heschel really struggles with is he doesn't really like the fact that in the rabbinic tradition, the most important tefillah is the Amidah. I think he will wrestle against that phenomenon. Because I think for him, actually, it's the stuff that comes before. It's actually the thanking God for the existence of the world. Okay. Now, wonder for Heschel is coupled with a sense of what he calls indebtedness. Indebtedness is closely tied to what we would call gratitude. Those of you who are in my class on Rabbeinu Bachya, we actually talked about this week. The difference between gratitude and indebtedness, I think, is indebtedness already carries with it a deeper sense of obligation than wonder. Than gratitude. In other words, according to Heschel, and this is a kind of very fundamental point to him, some find this convincing, some find this a little bit forcing a lot into the experience of wonder, but inextricably woven with a sense of wonder is a sense of what he calls at one point owingness. A sense that because my life has been bestowed upon me by someone else, my fundamental posture in the world is not one of owning the world, but of actually owing something. There is a sense in which I am indebted. When I consider the fact that the world did not have to be, and that my life within it did not have to be, I am oriented towards a kind of desire, as it were, to pay back. That experience, which he thinks is available to all human beings, is the portal, right, that opens us to the possibility of being commanded. In other words, Heschel begins with what he thinks, and we can sort of discuss later whether or not we think this is convincing. He begins with what he thinks is a kind of universally available human experience, a sense of wonder coupled with indebtedness. And that general human experience is what makes possible a response to a particular revelation that is Judaism. But Judaism begins with a fundamental human experience, not with a particularly Jewish experience. That's actually very important in 20th century theological debates, and if that's relevant or interesting to people, we can talk about it. Now, at bottom, in other words, wonder means that I am not the creator. And that therefore, and now I'm going to use an image that's from stuff that I've written, but I think it captures something Heschel would say. The first word I say is not I. The first word I say is not I. I think in many ways, that's kind of the fundamental reorientation that Heschel wants to elicit from us, right, is the realization that the first thing I should say as a human being who is awake to the world is not I, but something more like, thank you. Or, as he puts it, as I become more and more spiritually awake, I realize that the fundamental question in human life is not a question I ask, but a question which I am asked. Right? I comes second. Now, this is me talking, not him, but some of you have heard me say this. This is what I think is going on in the Modeh Ani prayer, right? When Jews traditionally wake up in the morning, the first words they say are Modeh Ani or Moda Ani, grateful am I, and not Ani Modeh, I am grateful, or Ani Moda, I am grateful. In other words, I think the claim of that liturgy is, for those who are kind of willing to be present to it, is there is actually no self without gratitude. And there certainly is no self without a fundamental sense of indebtedness and gratefulness. First I am grateful, and only then I am I. So in other words, for Heschel, wonder is tied to a sense of openness, receptivity, responsiveness. I am fundamentally open and responsive to the world outside me, and we can say it this way, both to the other, the human other, and to the other with a capital O, God. A lack of wonder, in contrast, I think a really helpful way for thinking about this, a lack of wonder for Heschel is what I would call a sense of self-enclosure. I am totally shut down into myself. There is no permeability of myself. I am not open to the possibility of encountering another, let alone of encountering the other, right? What I am is fundamentally closed. That is what Heschel means in one of the great problems that Heschel ran into, is that very often people think his sentences are so beautiful that they don't actually stop to consider what they mean. And when he says that, I mean, this is a quote, indifference to the sublime wonder of living is the root of sin, that is a very non-intuitive sentence. Indifference to the sublime wonder of living is the root of sin. I think what he means is, indifference to wonder basically means I am shut down, I am unavailable, I am unresponsive, I am interested only in myself, the world consists only of me. That is the root of sin, in that that is what makes possible all kinds of horrific behavior in the world. In other words, let's put it in a slightly different way. Sometimes you read popular writers on wonder, and they talk about wonder as if it's an aesthetic category, right? You can go through life without wonder, but then you'll never appreciate art. For Heschel, wonder is profoundly an ethical and theological category. It is about what makes possible a sense of openness and responsiveness. In other words, the consequences of wonder are not that I don't have an aesthetic. The consequences of wonder are ultimately that I'm led to brutality, cruelty, selfishness. And if this doesn't seem intuitively obvious, we'll go a little further and see if it helps. Okay, so now a question. All of this about wonder, what does it have to do with prayer, self-transcendence, the official topic for tonight? The relevance, I want to suggest, is that for Heschel, although he doesn't develop this clearly very often, there really are fundamentally two orientations to the world. And the great danger of modern times, as he sees it, is that we have all but abandoned one and embraced the other. The two ways of encountering the world, the two ways of responding to the world, he calls, first, the way of wonder, and second of all, the way of expediency. Now, the word expediency is not a word, I think, that resonates for a lot of people. What he means by it, though, is extremely important, and I think you can't get his worldview without really focusing on what he means. Expediency essentially means self-interest, and when he uses it, it actually means a kind of almost monomaniacal focus exclusively on self-interest. I am only interested in what can the world do for me, or more forcefully, how can I use this? According to Heschel, that is the question of modernity. How can I use this? For those of you interested in philosophy, that is Heschel reading Heidegger. How can I use this, right? The technological way of seeing the world, which threatens to cut out all other ways of seeing. Now, a couple of passages from him that will make what I'm trying to get to here clearer, I hope. In the way of expediency, now this is a quote, we accumulate information in order to dominate. In the way of wonder, quote, we deepen our appreciation in order to respond. Right? In other words, the way of expediency is about human power and human self-assertion. The way of wonder is about responsiveness, being called. Something else makes a claim upon me. The way of wonder, in other words, is fundamentally isolating. The way of expediency, he says, opens us up to the reality of, quote, living in the great fellowship of all beings. It actually connects us to the world rather than forcing us into isolation. Did I just say that backwards? Yes. Sorry. Okay. What all this means, in other words, now we're going to introduce the vocabulary that I think is even more important to him, is that life is fundamentally an ongoing struggle between the impulses to, on the one hand, self-assertion, that's the way of expediency, and on the other hand, self-transcendence, that's the way of wonder. As he puts it, there is a perpetual tension in man between focus on the self and the goal that lies beyond the self. Animal in man is driven to concentrate on the satisfaction of needs. Spiritual in man is the will to serve higher ends. And in serving higher ends, he transcends his needs. Now, obviously, any dichotomization like this is oversimplified, right? Any kind of typological thinking, we can throw a million more complex cases that don't fit neatly into either of these categories. But Heschel's point, the point of typological thinking, is to help us sort of just clarify what the options that lie before human beings are. And his claim is that essentially human life is a pull, a constant pull between focusing exclusively on what I want, and reorienting towards what is asked of me. What does someone else need of me? What does God want of me? This is him again. We are attached to two centers, to the focus of ourself and to the focus of God. Driven by two forces, we have both the impulse to acquire, to enjoy, to possess, and the urge to respond, to yield, to give. Implicit in that, by the way, is another important word, which is acquisitiveness. Acquisitiveness is part of technological modernity. I want to get stuff. Now, here's the piece that makes the spiritual life interesting for Heschel. And that is, as he puts it, the grand premise of religion is that man is able to surpass himself. Right? The grand premise of religion is that man is able to surpass himself. That is, even though there are really deep, instinctual, and then culturally reinforced forces within us that cultivate selfishness, that cultivate the will to power, that cultivate the desire to assert myself more and more firmly, more and more powerfully, there is also always the possibility of refraining, restraining, and then responding. That is the possibility with which human beings are equipped. That, by the way, he would say is, without that, the whole project of religion makes no sense, and the project of human living has no hope. Right? If we're not capable of self-transcending, if all we're capable of is self-asserting, then we essentially live in a jungle. And Heschel, whose world is destroyed by the Holocaust, as he gets older, it seems like he gives more and more voice to precisely the anxiety that, in fact, we do live in a jungle. And then he has to ask the question of why would God allow us to live in a jungle, which is another interesting discussion that maybe we can get to later on. Now here, I just want to point out something that I think is interesting and worth thinking about. If we take Heschel seriously here, I think we actually come upon a very interesting contrast between the Jewish sense of the tragedy of human life and the Christian sense of the tragedy of human life. Meaning, if you were to read Martin Luther would say, you know what the tragedy of human life is? We are fundamentally and permanently incapable of responding to God. We are incapable of knowing God, let alone of responding to God's will. And there is something deeply tragic and horrific about the human condition as a result. If you were to read Heschel, what you would find is something very different, and I think he would claim much more tragic. which is human beings do have the capacity to know God, do have the capacity to respond and do God's will, and yet an overwhelming preponderance of the time fail to do so. So I have a feeling, now I'm sort of totally putting words in his mouth, that he would say that on one level Judaism is of course profoundly, like in basic ways, much more optimistic than Christianity, and yet that very optimism generates a really profound sense of tragedy. Read the prophets. Right? The prophets make no sense if basically we're incapable of caring for the widows and the orphans. They make sense only if we are capable and are failing. That's the claim. Right? In other words, this is very much a theology of human freedom. In the really deep, robust sense of human freedom. Now, I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by this term self-transcendence in a minute, but I want to actually just throw out two thoughts that Heschel himself just sort of throws out almost in passing. The first is the claim that true joy is possible only in self-transcendence and basically never in self-assertion, right? That true joy is experienced in the moment of giving and responding to the other and never in just asserting myself more forcefully. That also is a kind of critique of modernity, right? Where the pursuit of happiness is, if I just got more things, if I just had more success, if I just had a greater reputation, however you want to finish this sentence. And Heschel says it's actually the opposite. Joy is found in a certain kind of letting go of self-assertion and committing to a certain kind of responsiveness. The second claim, and this is, I think, often the hardest claim in an American kind of milieu to make sense of. The claim is that true freedom only exists in self-transcendence. In other words, let me put this my language again. Being enslaved to impulse is not the same thing as freedom. And a tremendous amount of popular discourse is around freedom is the freedom to do what I want. And Heschel actually makes the claim, right, that to use rabbinic language, ipcha mistabra, right? The exact opposite is the case. The constant need to do what I want is really nothing more than a form of imprisonment. It's a form of imprisonment to impulse. The capacity to actually decide, if you want to say this more meditatively, the capacity to breathe and decide, right, is actually fundamental to what it means to live freely. And he says, by the way, something that is really powerful, which is that freedom is an event, not a state that we achieve. No one is free. We have moments when we achieve freedom. So, the problem to which Heschel thinks religion will be an answer, and prayer in particular will be an answer, is that modernity, he claims, is all about the death of wonder and the triumph of expediency. That's what modernity is in his mind. Maybe I'll just sort of add here as a momentary digression that something that he does that I think is actually quite interesting, and this too has interesting resonances with Heidegger, is he actually says the danger of the culture of expediency, the culture of using things, is that it's like a boomerang. Right? When a human being's only question is, how can I use this? Ultimately, we too become objects. Right? The culture of expediency, in which everything around me is something to be utilized, ends up in a place when I myself am something to be utilized too. I actually recently read an essay by a contemporary philosopher whose name I will not mention, in which he actually makes the case that the joy of technological modernity is that our bodies are like our cars and our houses. We can use them to get what we want. Right? And I think Heschel's point is, that's what I'm talking about. Right? You might have gotten tenure for saying that, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. That is the illness of modernity. Okay, now, so Let's return to the question for a second. What does all this have to do with praying? So the answer for Heschel, I would contend, is that prayer is a process of self-cultivation. It's a process of fashioning a different kind of self. That is what we're doing when we're praying. We are trying to be a different kind of self than the selves that tend to emerge in human life, and again, all the more so in modernity, he thinks. That is, the selves that are focused on expediency and the instrumental view of the world. How can it serve me? If you prefer a different kind of language, which Heschel flirts with at times, although never quite develops, and this is common in other 20th century spiritual writers, prayer is about allowing our true self to emerge and letting our false self, which is the self that we tend to act on all the time, fade into the background. The false self is the self that thinks, what I need is a new car. What I need is to be famous. What I need is fill in the blanks. That's the false self. That's the self. We're going to see Soloveitchik, interestingly, sort of claim that's the self that is constituted by advertising. That's the false self that modernity is especially good at cultivating. And prayer is an attempt to re-elicit the true self. The true self that's actually interested in things like responsiveness, reciprocity, love, a sense of obligation, a sense of commitment. Now, I want to suggest the following sort of fundamental claim that Heschel's making. Again, these are my words. We obsess about self-expression in modernity. Right? We want to find a way to express ourselves. But Heschel says, essentially, that we have it all wrong. We have it completely backwards. That is, the tragic irony of his perspective is, the more human beings assert themselves, the farther away they end up from true self-expression. Since, paradoxically, it is only through self-transcendence that true self-expression can be achieved. I want to say that one more time, right? The more we assert ourselves, the further we are from actually expressing our deepest, truest self. To put this in another way, because the more assertive we are, the more rawly assertive we are, the more likely we are to be imprisoned in our false self. So the irony is that self-expression requires self-transcendence. True self-expression is not about the pursuit of fame for its own good. No publicity is bad publicity. Right? It is the fundamental repudiation of that whole orientation to the world. True self-expression, like freedom, like joy, requires self-transcendence. That's the claim that he puts before us. And prayer is fundamentally a project of reorienting us to, depending on what language you want, discover or rediscover that. Discover because it seems so foreign to us most of the time. Rediscover because one of Heschel's claims is that by dint of being created in the image of God, there is some part of us, however buried and silenced, that always knows that. Right? There is some piece of the human being that is connected to God no matter what. And that is a claim, by the way, that is pervasive in all kinds of 20th century, not just actually classical Jewish theology, classical Christian theology, some classical Islamic theology. There's some piece we can violate, we can degrade, we can bury, but we can't fully abrogate. That's the claim. That's why the language of rediscovering our true self might be better than discovering our true self. So, Heschel says, prayer is, quote, the least expedient, the least worldly, the least practical thing we do. Prayer is the repudiation of expediency. Religion in general, at least ideally, I want to underline that because Heschel is not dumb, and he is aware that religion very often can be the exact opposite of this. But religion is, ideally, it is an alternative to use a sentence of his that is never cited anywhere I've seen, but I think is quite eloquent. Religion is an alternative to the hating, hunting, and hurting, end quote, which ordinarily dominate our lives. Prayer, in other words, is a kind of self-purification. It is like It is a moment in which we remember, he calls, this is a quote, the gratefulness that makes our soul great. The gratefulness that makes our soul great. Prayer is an opportunity to remember that. So if modernity is about self-assertion, Heschel says, then prayer is about forgetting the self, that's his language, even if only for a moment. Or to stand for something greater than ourselves. Or as he says, I believe in a few places, unless we are more than human, we are less than human. We can unpack that sentence later if that is needed. Or another sentence from Heschel, the function of prayer is to overcome our egocentric predicament. The essence of prayer lies in man's self-transcending. Now, if you look at the sheets that I think most people got, if you look at those sheets for a minute, I wanted to just share with you a passage, actually two passages, where Heschel tries to develop this idea. The image might seem strange, but I think it's actually very important to him. So first, from his central book on prayer, Man's Quest for God, Heschel says the following: we do not step out of the world when we pray. We merely see the world in a different setting. The self is not the hub, but the spoke of the revolving wheel. In prayer, we shift the center of living from self-consciousness to self-surrender. God is the center toward which all forces tend. Now, we could read on, but I want to just underline that sentence for a second. The self is not the hub, but the spoke of the revolving wheel. The argument there is an image that's actually popular in postmodern circles, although Heschel used it before and in different ways. It is an image of decentering the self, right? It is an image of, it's actually a definition, in a sense, of what self-transcendence is. Self-transcendence is moving the self out of the constant center of my life to the point where there are only two questions I ask. One, as we've talked about, how can I use this? And two, how am I experiencing this? Martin Buber especially will sort of emphasize that latter point, where at a certain point, if all I ask is how am I experiencing this, the only thing I ever experience is myself. Right? Does that make sense for people? Or just to flesh that out for a second, for Buber, it's interesting, for Buber, who despite Heschel's protestations that this is not the case, had really profound influence on Heschel. For Buber, experience is a kind of dirty word. And encounter is a kind of holy word. And the difference between experience and encounter is, this is straight I and Thou, right, from the work I and Thou. Experience means I'm interested in how something or someone outside me affects me. So in other words, everything that happens is within me. Encounter is the creation of a reality that is genuinely between me and something or someone. The creation of what Buber calls the between. Das Zwischen, that which is an actual intersubjective space. Or, now, to use my language for a second, ...99.9% of the time, some of you have heard me say this, this is one of the things I think it really captures Buber, 99.9% of the time, there is, in my life, there is me, and there is the way you make me feel. And then every once in a while, there's me and there's you. And there's actually a between that's not just about how you make me feel, how you are refracted in my experience. Buber thinks that's when we become fully human. That's the I and Thou. That is, by the way, the book I and Thou in a nutshell, right? That's the argument. Essentially, there is a between. A between emerges. It's not just about me. Now, what this means, by the way, is that writers who are interested in self-transcendence are not just interested in this as an ethical practice, but they're also interested in a kind of spiritual practice, because in some ways the ill of modernity, even if you can brush aside, oh, I'm not so self-assertive as to need this kind of, you know, brutal critique of modern human beings, what thinkers like Heschel, Buber, in a different idiom, Thomas Merton, many others will say is, yeah, but you're still pretty self-preoccupied. You basically go through life observing yourself going through life. Or as Evelyn Underhill puts it, right, we go through life, even the spiritual among us, taking our devotional pulses all day. Right? Oh, how was that for me? It's all about me. Of course, the dilemma here is, and this is especially true if you've spent your life, as I have, teaching these things to people in their late teens, 20s, 30s, or for that matter, actually, any humans. If they take this seriously, they then end up spending all their time thinking about how to not think about themselves all the time. That's a dilemma, right? And that's the challenge of this. How do you do this without kind of this morass of self-preoccupation? Now, so in other words, we have these two intertwined notions, self-transcendence and decentering the self. They may even be the same notion. I'm not really sure. Now, Heschel's claim is that ultimately prayer does this work, and it does it by reorienting us away from questions like, what can I get? And two questions like, how can I serve? What is asked of me? That means that for Heschel, he is going to say very forcefully that the essence of prayer is not bakasha, is not petition. Right? The essence of prayer is praise. Because praise is ultimately not about me. That, I think, is also the reason why I used to personally be obsessed with the question of why the High Holiday Liturgy is structured the way it is, with God as this ostensibly vain character, right? Where you spend, you know, 25 hours in Yom Kippur, or actually, let's say with Rosh Hashanah, we spend 40-some hours on Rosh Hashanah telling God how wonderful God is, and then we stop only to tell God how wonderful He is again, right? And I actually think that what the liturgy is trying to do there is something totally different, which is to train us to say you. It's actually about overcoming the constant need to talk about ourselves and to assert ourselves. You, you, you. I am responding to you. It is about a kind of reorientation, which may be, by the way, another reason why on Rosh Hashanah, although we constantly tell ourselves we're going to do this, we never say things like, I sinned and I failed. Maybe the rabbis are nervous that if I spend all of Rosh Hashanah doing that, I'm still thinking about myself over much. There's a time for that. It will come. But for now, let's train ourselves to be focused on you. Now, Heschel takes this so far that he's going to make the claim, and it's a little counterintuitive, I think, for a lot of us, he's going to make the claim that even the bakashot, even the petitions at the heart of the Amidah, and remember, the Amidah in rabbinic discourse is referred to simply as tefillah, right? The prayer is the Amidah. The heart of the Amidah is, on a weekday, 13 requests. Heschel is going to make the case that the essence of those prayers is not petition at all, but something different. Look at source 2 for a minute. The focus of prayer is not the self. He says, prayer comes to pass in a complete turning of the heart toward God, toward His goodness and power. It is the momentary disregard of our personal concerns, the absence of self-centered thoughts, which constitute the art of prayer. Feeling becomes prayer in the moment in which we forget ourselves and become aware of God. Now, the move here is going to be, look, I know if I turn to the liturgy of the Amidah, it's going to sound a lot like this is about my trying to wheedle stuff out of God. So I'm not going to turn to the liturgy. I'm going to turn to a phenomenology, to a kind of attempt to get inside the mind and the heart of the person who is praying. And this is what he says. When we analyze the consciousness of a supplicant, we discover that it is not concentrated upon his own interests, but on something beyond the self. The thought of personal need is absent, and the thought of divine grace alone is present in his mind. Thus, in beseeching God for bread, There is one instant, at least, in which our mind is directed neither to our hunger nor to food, but to God's mercy. That instant is prayer. It's almost like Heschel wants to say, all the words of Rifa'enu Hashem ben Erafe, heal us, all of it is a preparation for prayer. And the moment of prayer is when we describe God as Rofei Choleamu Yisrael, the sheer praise of God, the God who is healer. In other words, I just want to sort of point out how dramatic this chutzpah is, right? The claim is, not only is petitionary prayer not the center, but petitionary prayer is in fact not petitionary at all. It's something else. It's a kind of subtle inducement to praise. And the real person at prayer will realize this as he or she grows in prayer. Now, you can imagine many people issuing all kinds of critiques of this. And we're going to actually see next week Rabbi Soloveitchik essentially say, no, the essence of prayer is begging. Heschel is concerned that if what you're doing is begging, you haven't really self-transcended. I think, although he does not engage this philosophically, that Soloveitchik's response would have been, actually, begging is a profound acknowledgement that I can't do it myself, and that too is a total act of self-transcendence, especially in modern times, right? What is as difficult as saying, I am fundamentally needy and vulnerable? In other words, these are two very different ways of thinking about what it means to transcend the self. But what's clear and shared is the total rejection of the idea that I say the Amida because I hope God's going to give me stuff. That is not the project of the Amida. Now, I actually just included here, this has nothing to do intrinsically with Heschel, other than that it's a thought he would have loved. Source 3, the contemporary Christian philosopher Meyrold Westphal, says the following. We can distinguish praise from thanksgiving as follows. To give thanks is to praise God for the good things I have received from God, while to praise God is to thank God for who God is, for what Luther calls God's bare goodness, considered without reference to how I may benefit from it. In other words, the claim is that even thanks is not the highest form of prayer because it still involves being focused on me. That, I also, by the way, would suggest is the meaning of yirah in Jewish theology, right? You may know that the word yirah, yirat shamayim, has two, at least in the rabbinic mind, contiguous meanings, right? One is the fear of God and one is the awe of God. And it's not, I think, that for an English-speaking context where those words are not the same word, it's not intuitively obvious how fear and awe go together. But I think that what Jewish theology gropes for is the claim that when fear ceases to be about me, it becomes awe. In other words, fear is, God, you are mighty and awesome. Oh my God, what you could do to me. Awe is, oh my God, you are awesome and mighty. Sof pasuk, right? End of conversation. It is about a self-transcended fear is awe. And it's interesting, by the way, despite what your 7th grade yeshiva day school teacher might have told you, right, that an overwhelming majority of Jewish texts that I've ever seen will emphasize that although there is a place for fear, ultimately, the aspiration is to arrive at a very different kind of yirah, what in many texts is called yirat haromimut, as opposed to yirat haonesh. That is, awe of God's glory, as opposed to the fear of being punished. But again, notice that yirah is the same word. Or as the late Rabbi Louis Jacobs once said, fear is in fact not fear of God, but rather fear of what God might do. Which is why, ultimately, we aspire to awe. Now, I'm going to leave out a few things I wanted to say, and I want to just maybe conclude with two overarching thoughts. One of which is, I'll say somewhat opaquely, about Inyana Diyoma, about things that are sort of talked about a lot in the Jewish world these days. Many thinkers, especially mystical thinkers, who talk about self-transcendence, also talk about the notion that in an ideal, achieved spiritual state, self-transcendence would culminate in what they often call self-annihilation, selflessness, the lack of any self at all. You find this in all kinds of spiritual writers. If you've ever read a 20th century Christian mystics, Thomas Merton, Evelyn Underhill in her early phase, right? It's all about ultimately obliterating a sense of an individual self. Heschel thinks that that idea is A, delusional, and B, blasphemous. And I wanted to sort of think out loud for a second about why that is. It's delusional because never trust anyone who says, I no longer have a self. Or, as I like to say, a little bit nervous about saying this every time I say it, but what you end up with is an American spiritual scene, which is a bunch of men with huge egos running around talking about egolessness. Right? I've totally transcended that, which is why I have total moral license, I can do what I want, I'm on a different spiritual plane. So it's a delusion that not only is a form of lying to myself, but it's a delusion that leads to unspeakable moral license. But also, Heschel is against mystical union, the notion of being fully one with God, because, and this is why, and the language of blasphemy is his, not mine, because, first of all, he thinks it violates the transcendence of God. What do you mean you've merged with God? And second of all, although you think you're flattering yourself, you're actually violating your own dignity by making that claim. Because human dignity comes from being commanded, being called, being beckoned, being summoned by a God who is not me. And ultimately, if I am God and God is me, there is no commandment, there is no God, there is no me, there is no discourse of obligation, there is no discourse of mitzvah that makes any sense. All you have is a kind of cosmic soup. In other words, if everything is God, then there is in fact, if everything is God, nothing is God. And if everything is God, then essentially I am God. And then we've left blasphemy behind and entered into full-out idolatry. So, the claim here is, in other words, I would say, this is my language for what Heschel is after, is that the covenant itself is never left behind, because the very notion of a covenant itself means that there are always two, right? That's Buber's language of encounter. In order for covenant to make sense, I and God cannot be the same. Right? That should be, I mean, Heschel thinks that should be intuitively obvious, but it isn't. By the way, it also wasn't intuitively obvious to many very important Jewish thinkers, right? Many Hasidic masters flirt with very robust notions of mystical union. Heschel, who revered his Hasidic master forebears, sort of ignores that aspect of their writing, and instead, as he often does when he wants to sort of attack the notion of mysticism, he attributes it to the Greeks. That's, first of all, what you do, and that's what 20th century Jewish and Christian theological discourse in lots of places did, right? This is a whole nother, right? Construct Athens and Jerusalem, Hebrew thinking and Greek thinking. And obviously both of those things, the complexity and richness of both of those things gets flattened in that kind of typology. But Greece is everything that biblical theology detests. By the way, that's why Martin Buber said that as he matured, he left any interest in mysticism behind. Right? By the time Buber writes I and Now, he thinks mysticism... I want to be clear what mysticism means to him here. Mysticism means the notion that I can be completely one with God. God and I are one thing. By the time he writes I Now, he thinks that that is just a symptom of religious immaturity and moral irresponsibility. And the language Buber wants to replace that with is not mysticism, but dialogue. Dialogue, again, is about two selves, two centers of consciousness interacting. In Heschel's language, that's the contrast between prophecy and mysticism. If you look for a second at source 4, just very briefly, he says this: prophecy is a confrontation. God is God and man is man. The two may meet, but they never merge. There is a fellowship, but never a fusion. Prophetic consciousness is marked by a shuddering sense of the unapproachable holiness of God. The prophet knows there is a chasm that cannot be bridged, a distance that cannot be conquered. That is, in other words, you can have unity, you can have a kind of unanimity where you adjust your will to match God's, but what you can't have is full union, or, as some mystics talk about, identity. In other words, although the self is intrinsically attached to God, the self is not God. If you read Thomas Merton, you will find moments where Thomas Merton will say things like, when the self has been fully realized, one notices that the self really is God. Heschel would have, let's say, frowned upon that formulation. If you want a version of that from Buber, source 5 has that, which we won't talk about now. Now, finally, the last thought about prayer in Heschel, and this is where the sort of prayer in the context of his broader theology and spirituality becomes, I think, challenging, inspiring, troubling, depending on where you're sitting in a particular moment. One of the fundamental theological claims Heschel makes is that God is transcendent, but whether or not God is immanent depends on human freedom and decision making. Human beings, in other words, have the freedom, through the power of their actions, either to welcome God's presence into the world or to essentially chase God out of the world. The first image of that, by the way, as I'm thinking about it, as I'm standing here, is actually in Bereshit Rabbah, which, although Heschel, I don't think, ever quotes this, is an image in Bereshit Rabbah of beginning with Adam and seven people after him, the Shekhinah leaves the world with every sin, and then, I think it's beginning with Avraham, the Shekhinah begins to get pulled back into the world. I think that Midrash, quoted and not quoted, is what creates a lot of possibilities for Kabbalah and other discourses in Judaism. This is perhaps most famously encapsulated in the Kutzker Rebbe's famous story, right? Student says to the Kutzker, where does God dwell? The Kutzker's answer, where does God dwell? God dwells wherever we let God in. Heschel's argument is God also doesn't dwell wherever we don't let God in. Now, he moves between, and I want to sort of end with this in a way. He moves between the language of divine hiddenness and the language of divine exile. And what I think is striking about Heschel's use of these images is that, as far as I can tell, never once in all of his writing does he notice, or let's say this, does he point any attention to, if he does notice, that those images are actually somewhat in tension with each other. Divine hiddenness suggests that as a response to human cruelty and sinfulness, God makes a decision to turn away and hide God's face. Divine exile suggests that something is, as it were, done to God. Heschel moves between these images, often within one sentence. But actually, it's a very interesting tension that is not worked out at all. He also moves, and this is actually, I think, this tension reflects Chazal, reflects the rabbis. He moves between a notion of God being absent from the world, now I'll say it in philosophies for a second, but that is epistemological, and a notion that God being absent from the world that is ontological. The epistemological one is sort of safer theologically. It means God is here, but human consciousness is unaware of God. The ontological means, on some level, God is actually not in the world. And if you look, we won't do it now because I want to leave some time for conversation. At sources 6 and 7, I gave you examples from Heschel's writings where each of those images is used, right? Either that through the act of prayer and self-transcendence, we allow God back into the world, or that's what we call ontology, or through prayer and self-transcendence, we enable humanity to see what it has heretofore been blind to. That's epistemology. Now, this is truly the last sort of ribbon I want to sort of tie here. What is the relationship between prayer as an attempt to bring God back into the world and prayer as the cultivation of self-transcendence? The connection for Heschel is that it is, in his mind, the human preoccupation with self-assertion, with human beings and their wishes as the very center of the world, that is what banishes God's presence from the world. In other words, it is self-assertion that is the cause of divine exile. And conversely, it is self-transcendence that is a portal for God to return to the world, or, again, more modestly, to return to human consciousness. To pray, in other words, is to restore our sensitivity to God, which comes with our sensitivity to wonder, which comes with our sensitivity to that which is outside of me making a claim on me. In other words, less ego makes possible more God. That's the basic argument of Heschel's whole vision of spirituality. And his vision of spirituality and his theology are so interwoven that I'm not even sure it makes sense to distinguish them. But that's the basic claim. If we were to import language from Kabbalah here, we would say that it is a kind of theology of human tzimtzum. It is a kind of theology of human self-contraction, where I don't exercise all the power I have to assert myself, lest the world become an inferno. And the claim that other people make on me and the claim that God makes upon me are about my capacity to respond rather than assert. That's where my dignity lies. That's where my freedom lies. And that, Heschel argues, is where joy lies. And that's what prayer, in its most alive moments, makes possible. Okay, so I'll stop there. And the floor is open for thoughts, reflections, tomatoes. John. Thank you.
How to articulate this question, but Heschel's outlook is based obviously very fundamentally on the notion that the world is good and that it's good to be alive. And against that, he shows where not thinking that, not sensing that, leads to certain almost demonic kind of implications.
Right.
But what would Heschel say to some, do you think, what would Heschel, do you think, say to someone who simply says, the world is neither good nor bad. There may be another source of ethics, but I'm not grateful because the world is simply a fact whose value is indifferent. That, you know, when you tell the story from Heschel, it's clear from within his terms to see why that kind of thinking leads to demonic implications. But in fact,
right,
there are perfectly decent, well-behaved, even kind people who would philosophically reject the notion,
right,
that gratitude is the logical or the natural or the best way to,
right,
sort of open your eyes.
So, I mean, it's a great question. Actually, it's about 20 great questions that you've actually just asked in that formulation. And trying to sort of decide how to go at it. So let me say this. I think that one has a choice in encountering a theistic thinker who believes ineluctably, as a result of being a theist, that there is a truth available to belief in God that is absent and sorely lacking in a lack of belief in God. It's one possibility, and say, of course he believes that. Another possibility is to say, okay, maybe, but perhaps your intimation that this is really the only hope for humanity is a little bit unreflective about the cultural conditioned nature of your assumptions. Right? And this is something that I have written about that I think is the great Achilles heel in Heschel's theology. He thinks that his fundamental intuitions about the world are everyone's fundamental intuitions about the world if they wake up more deeply to the fact that they have these intuitions, which most of them don't, and that makes him angry. Now, on one level, again, you could say, how could he not think that? If you believe, as he does really deeply, in a universal God who loves all of humanity and wants to enter into a relationship with it, how can you not think that? On the other hand, the kind of presumptuousness that comes from assuming that I can describe what human life is like, and at moments even say things like, there is no good faith atheism, right? Now, we could get into the question of, in a quiet, discursive conversation at Starbucks, would Heschel have said those things? Or, in his writings, is he kind of waxing rhetorical and rhapsodic in order to jolt people out of the kind of cultural sovereignty of atheism? I don't know the answer to that. But I think it's a fair claim. I mean, look, I would ask your question in a way even more forcefully. For Heschel, wonder is so dramatically tied to a sense already of God's presence that you wonder what Heschel would make of a great Buddhist master saying, wonder I get, but there's some source to whom, and you're going to use the word whom, I owe a response. I literally have no idea what you're talking about. And I think Heschel was unable, unwilling to reflect on the cultural context that nurtured him. I think he didn't do that. And it would be interesting had he lived 20 years longer, when that's all the academy did and it overdid that, right? Where all we have is perspectivalism, how would he have, or would he have, engaged that question? It also is connected to, I think, an anxiety that he does admit, but rarely. Heschel is committed to the view that only religion, I want to say this carefully, only religion can save humanity as a whole from its most brutal impulses. I don't think he thinks that about individual humans. He thinks that about humanity. The problem is, as he at moments will say, is, yeah, if we're keeping score, religion's not doing so well. Right? Because often, in fact, it accomplishes precisely the opposite. That is a very real dilemma. And I think, by the way, sort of al mishkavo balilot, right? You know, if you had gotten Heschel, you know, in his most honest moments, what's the answer to that question? That's why we have to fight like hell for what religion means. Right? Or as he puts it at one point, right? We have to rescue the Bible. We have to rescue the Bible from its most impassioned adherents. So that's almost the sentence in chapter 27 of God in Search of Man, something like that, right? We have to rescue the Bible. And so, I mean, I've given you a lot of sort of non-answers or half-answers, but I think you're getting at really what I think are the most nettlesome issues in Heschel's theology, but also the most nettlesome issues in whether and how a notion of a universal God requires making certain kinds of universalistic claims about the good life. I mean, much more to say about that, obviously. Max, were you going to say that?
I had a question about your repeated references to modernity. Are these issues that really only arise in modern life, or aren't they perpetual human issues?
Yes. Great. So that's a great question. One of my students, Jen Taylor Friedman, likes to say that one of the signs of the narcissism of modernity is that we think all our problems are uniquely ours, right? And I think that there is something to that, although it's also overstated. I think that what Heschel would say is, look, the prophets didn't live in the 19th century. They were aware of selfishness long before modernity unfolded, and the Jewish tradition was obsessed with the Yetzer Hara and the desire for power and self-assertion long before modernity. I think what he would say is that modernity serves to accentuate that which is always there, but it almost obliterates our shame at letting it run wild. Right? In other words, modernity takes this impulse and it puts it at the very center of our culture and society. Now, we should be clear about this. Heschel is not, he's not a Luddite. He's not opposed to technology. I mean, at all. Right? And this is actually an important point about Heidegger too. Right? He is opposed to what Heidegger calls the technological enframing of the world. That is, the way of seeing the world that is only technological. In other words, when the only question you ask is, how is this utilizable? It's not that that question is illegitimate. It's that in modernity, that question, they claim, crowds out almost any other question. Is that overstated? Maybe. It's a kind of rhetorical point that's meant to sort of jolt the reader. But so the answer to the question is sort of yes and no, right? It's always true, but it's played out in modernity in unique ways. And it may be a function of, there's a kind of spiral here between our increasing power to control nature, to control the world, which may be both the result and the cause of a greater preoccupation with human power and self-assertion. So it's very complicated. Rachel and then Eric.
I actually have two questions.
Of course you do. Yeah.
So my first question is, you said in the beginning that according to Heschel, organization is the ultimate poison. And I'm curious to know how...
I think it's the first poison. I think instrumentalization is the ultimate poison.
Okay, but it's not great.
No, it's poison.
Yeah. So I'm curious...
Routinization.
I'm curious how Heschel would think of Jewish prayer as it exists, and whether it actually allows for a person to truly pray.
That's the part that I skipped. So, okay, we want to tell me your second question so that while you do that, I'll forget the first one, then I'll ask you to remind me.
So my second question is, I'm a little uncomfortable with the sort of self-assertion versus self-transcendence thing for a number of reasons, but one of them is because to a certain extent, it seems to me like self-transcendence requires self-assertion. You can't transcend a self if you don't know what that self is.
Great. Okay. So let me... Okay, so the first question, Heschel struggles a lot and thinks a lot about the relationship between keva and kavana, or what he translates as wonderfully continuity and spontaneity. And his arguments are sort of manifold, right? There are a bunch of arguments. One of them is that without continuity, the kind of spontaneous prayer one desires would never happen. Right? In other words, if you wait to pray, or for that matter, to do any mitzvah, only when you're moved to do it, the odds are that you will never be moved to do it. Because spontaneity is a function of discipline. That's the claim. Now, is it the case that keva often runs the risk, that is fixity in prayer, of drowning out kavana? I think Heschel would say, of course, right? And that's why Judaism is being lived badly. But the answer to that is not to sort of jettison the polarity of keva and kavana, but to actually reassert and rediscover it. Also, this sort of second point I think he would make here is that he is nervous about prayer that is non-liturgical and fixed because he thinks that although that's important at moments, it runs the risk of precisely reinstituting an obsession with self-expression and saying just what I feel and want at this moment. He says at one point, I'm going to quote this wrong, but he says at one point, you know, in liturgy, the self is silent and Israel speaks, or something like that, some version of that. Meaning, I think he thinks that ideally, liturgy is not just words that I recite, but I am willing to be, to let something within me be elicited by the fixed words. Now, he describes that, and this is just the last thing I'll say in response to your first question. He describes that. This is a very interesting distinction he makes, and as far as I can tell, it's totally his. He makes a distinction between what he calls prayer of expression and prayer of empathy. Prayer of expression and prayer of empathy are two ways of approaching liturgy. Prayer of expression means I wake up in the morning and I feel grateful. I feel thrilled to be alive. I feel the world is beautiful. I feel that nature is marvelous. I feel that my life is marvelous. And I go to the liturgy seeking to express something that it helps me say. And he says, by the way, in passing, don't overestimate the human capacity to express one's deepest sense of gratitude. Many of us need liturgy. But then he says there's also something called a prayer of empathy. A prayer of empathy is when I wake up in the morning and I feel nothing. I feel nothing. I feel nothing but tired, crabby. I'm not sure the world is good. I'm certainly not sure I feel grateful. And I come to the words and I let them do the work. In other words, I don't come to the words to express what I already feel and seek to put into the world or to put into my relationship with God, but rather I come to the words in the hopes that they will elicit a certain way of being in the world and responding to it. So in other words, what I'm saying, Rachel, is I think Heschel thinks that when it works, there are a variety of ways in which actually keva cultivates kavana, in which discipline, both in terms of the words I say and the fixity of saying them regularly, actually is what elicits and makes possible spontaneity. That said, nobody had harsher things to say about the American synagogue and the reality of prayer than Heschel, right? Who, you know, says, for example, to the Rabbinical Assembly and the Central Conference of American Rabbis within a month of each other, the synagogue is the graveyard where prayer is buried. Right? He is not, you know, he is not deluded about the ways that religion often falls short. Now, to your second question, I don't know if you know this or not, but what you just said quite beautifully is an encapsulation of a very interesting debate in Christian theology. Because Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr both argued versions of the following. And in many ways, Heschel, I think, resonated with this. Sin is an overabundance of self. The condition of sin, right? Christians more often talk about state of sin rather than individual sins, right? State of sin is too much self. Until a feminist theologian who has the wonderful, wonderful name for a Christian theologian of Valerie Saving. Valerie Saving wrote an essay and she said, you know what? In my experience, that's a pretty male conception of sin. If I had to describe the sin of most of my female compatriots, I would say the sin is too little self. I would say we're shmatas. And there's no way we can transcend ourselves without first having a self. So you might want to think about the genderedness of your construction of sin. Now, I think Heschel is totally vulnerable to the same attack. That said, I also think there's a kind of pernicious underside to that critique, which is let's not sort of kid ourselves that the world is evenly divided between men who self-assert and selfless women who are shmatas. Right? There is truth in that critique, and there is also overstatement in it, potentially. And I think, by the way, that Heschel would himself deeply agree with what you said. That's part of what he means, I think, by talking about a self that is taken seriously by God in covenant. In other words, God doesn't command nobodies. What self-transcendence means is transcending sort of mere selfishness or mere desire to assert myself in the world. But crucially, to be part of a covenant, I need to have a self. He actually talks about at one point how in the prophetic experience, in contrast to the mystical experience as he understands it, not only is the self not dissolved, but the self is actually strengthened. Because after all, if God is sending you somewhere to do something, you damn well better have a self. So, the self-transcending self is not a weak self. That's why, you know, I actually like to describe what Heschel is talking about as, even though it's sort of clunky, but what I'm going for is the self that transcends itself. Because the self that transcends itself is actually about, there still is a self. It's just that it's self-transcendent. So, you should... I don't know if she's still alive, but you should email Valerie Saving. Eric. Come on, Eric, bring it on.
Yeah, it's the same old stuff you always get. I understand that theology is a murky academic discipline for obvious reasons. But
here we go, Eric. Get warmed up. Rub your hands together. Let's go. Yeah.
No, it's kind of simple. When I read Heschel, I have a lot of trouble that I don't have if I'm reading, say, Kaplan or Niebuhr or even Arne Eisen. Because Heschel's modus operandi is assertion. And I don't understand where his authority derives from. I don't understand how Heschel knows what God thinks and what God wants. Whereas other theologians, the ones who I feel more comfortable with, make arguments based on evidence that you can reject or agree with. But Heschel, I mean, you alluded to this earlier when you said Heschel seems to think that everyone would believe what he believed if only they thought more carefully about it. But from where? Why does Heschel think that he has this insight that the rest of the world doesn't have? And how can we judge that?
Okay, so maybe let me first critique your question. And then let me say something about Heschel's poetics, which I think are actually very important and maybe helpful for thinking about what he's doing. I do not think it's true that... I'm bracketing Arne Eisen, who I think of as a scholar of theology and as a sociologist of American Jewry, but not necessarily as a constructive theologian. Okay, but let's talk about... Mordechai Kaplan, by the way, that was not an insult to Arne Eisen, merely a categorization. Mordechai Kaplan, like any theologian, makes interpretive choices about what aspects of the tradition he wants to place front and center, and why, and how he wants to re-symbolize or reimagine fundamental symbols of the Jewish tradition. So when Mordechai Kaplan comes along and says something like, God is the power in the universe that makes for salvation. Or in other formulations, the process in the universe that makes for salvation. By the way, those are not the same things, but be that as it may, right? What's the source of that in Jewish tradition? Where does that come from? He was reading Bergson, and he thought it was a good way to interpret the God of the Jewish tradition. In other words, there's two things. Every theologian is going to A, insist that certain Jewish ideas are more central than others, and B, that he has some authority to reinterpret what those categories mean. By the way, here I am in West End Synagogue. Mordechai Kaplan had a profoundly presumptuous side. He was willing to poskin left and right about what modern man was capable or incapable of believing. Right? That, by the way, is the sort of standard social scientific thing in the 20th century. Modern man is no longer capable of believing X. Oops, right? Modern man still believes lots of things. So, I'm not sure that Kaplan is any freer of this charge than Heschel. I think by definition, this is what people do. And by the way, let's just sort of say this very dramatically, right? I mean, the rabbis do this. And students in the yeshiva have probably heard me say this before, but it's so important to sort of just think about this for a second. When Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai have an argument, right? The most famous argument they have. One of them says, love your neighbor as yourself. This is the, I have no idea how to translate Chag Klal Gadol BaTorah, but it is the great underlying principle of Torah, right? And Ben Azai says, no, creation in the image of God, that's the great underlying principle of the Torah. By what authority do they do that? Now fine, you can tell me they do it because God appointed them to do that and God told them what was the center. But what they also do in that moment is establish precedent for saying certain things are fundamental and they are read and other things are read in light of them. Right? As I always like to say, there is no Amora or Tana, there is no Talmudic sage who comes along and says, Lo tilbash shatnez, zeh klal gadol batorah. Right? You shouldn't wear shatnez, that is the essence of the Torah. Why not? It's a pasuk like any other pasuk. Why not? But a theologian, by definition, an interpreter of tradition, chooses to understand what he or she thinks is lies at the heart of the tradition and to read other things in light of it. Now, Heschel, I would say Heschel is at moments guilty of what you say, which is assertion, right? Mere assertion, as, by the way, I think are most theologians and many philosophers. But I would say what Heschel is trying to do is different than that. Heschel's goal is not assertion, but evocation. In other words, he does not think that he can convince you to feel wonder. He thinks that he can evoke in you some sense that you already do. Or jolt you out of a sense that wonder makes no sense. In other words, and here I want to say this very forcefully, right? People often say, this is especially true in the academy, right? Heschel is not a serious thinker. He's not a thinker, he's a poet. Right? That claim is, it's wrong on two counts, right? Because Heschel's whole point, I think, is that to say that I am a poet, not a theologian, is to fundamentally miss what I think theology sets out to do. I am a poet because I am a theologian. In other words, what does theology do? It's not just some abstract claim about, oh, there is a metaphysical entity called God. It is about fundamentally reorienting the whole human being, mind, body, heart, soul. And the way to do that is not through abstract philosophic prose that 12 people who also have tenure can understand, right? It's actually about moving the human being. That doesn't make it empty of ideational content. It actually makes it aimed at not just speaking to the mind, but also speaking to the fullness of the human. So, in other words, Heschel is a poet precisely because he's a theologian. He's a poet because he thinks theology is not about some philosophy seminar somewhere. It's about trying to move people. And the fact is, if I handed out an essay to everyone in this room in recent, I read this stuff, God forgive me, an analytic philosophy of religion, most people in this room would fall asleep. It would not change their life. And he knows that. And I think what he's doing is something very different, right? I mean, yes, there is a deeply homiletical urge in Heschel. But that's because of the work he's trying to do and because of his conception of what a person is and how a person can be moved and inspired. And by the way, I would say one step further. If you engage Heschel's theology, you discover that what does Heschel believe above all else about God? That God is a God of pathos, that God is a God who cares. You know what? You don't write in abstract philosophical sentences about a God who cares. You write with passion about the God of passion. That's why he writes the way he does. Does it veer into assertion? For sure it does. But sad as I am to say this, or maybe not, read Buber, read Rosenzweig, read lots of other people. You're going to find a fair bit of assertion in them too. And I would say, if it were up to me, the modesty that I would encourage upon Heschel's theology is, and he would not have liked this, but what it is a thick description of what it means to experience the world Jewishly as he understands that. Where I think it falls down is in its pretension to universality. And that's where the esoteric stuff rubs you really the wrong way, I suspect, right? Like, oh, this is the way the world is. You know, we live in a time where it's harder to say things like that. He died in 1972. It was only becoming hard to say things like that. I don't know if that's... Maybe that's letting him off too easily. But yeah, so I think... You know, one would have to be willing to engage. This is like the fundamental reorientation of basically all of philosophy. I mean, if there's one consensus in philosophy, right, in the last two decades, right, it's that basically, like, all experiences are to some extent culturally conditioned. Everybody thinks that. Heschel did not think that. Heschel didn't think it. He thought there was a pre-verbal, preconceptual, universally available experience of the divine. That idea has not fared well. Yeah, Shannon. And then Nigel, and then we'll end. So last two questions.
From the studio audience?
Oh.
I'm sorry, we're the studio audience.
From the internet audience?
Okay.
Wow.
Hello? Okay, so the question is, I understand that Heschel's goal of prayer is to cultivate the capacity for self-transcendence. Is his view that engaging in obligatory, communal, liturgical worship is the best or only means to such?
So I hear in that question some resonances to Rachel's, you know, first question. I don't know that he would say only. I would be very surprised if he would say only. I think he would say that... This is now, I'm a little bit putting words into his mouth, but I think this is fair characterization. Praying with other people is also pretty fundamental to self-transcendence. Because it actually makes you live with other people and realize that you're not the only person there. And by the way, that's another thing that Jewish liturgy does that I think is really important. Even when you feel really needy, you're forced to pray in the plural. But God, I'm sick. And nevertheless, I say, heal us. There is a profound form of self-transcendence and openness that is made possible by that reality. It's yet another dimension of the way that I think traditional structured prayer for him makes self-transcendence at least possible at moments. You know, one of the things that floats around Lurianic Kabbalah is the practice of looking around the room before you start davening with a tzibur and saying, Hareini mekabel alei mitzvat haborei v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, right? I take upon myself the divine commandment, you should love your neighbor as yourself, right? I can't daven with other people unless I love them. I mean, how am I saying we when that guy in the row behind me makes me sick? It actually doesn't work. There's a dishonesty in that liturgy. Liturgy challenges me to actually love the people I'm with. That's self-transcendence. So, okay. Now, Nigel, last question, and then...
Yeah, I just want to... The whole notion of... Quite in Heschel, the notion of the tension between wonder and expediency, and the way that you've presented it, I find very, very attractive and very engaging, very persuasive. And in a sense, two opposite sides of it. One is, I'm still struggling with how you connect that back to a Jewish God. Like you were saying, look, it's persuasively universal. I forget which way around you said it, but I'm struggling with the opposite. How is, if at Shirat Hayam we are celebrating that the Egyptians got killed in the Dead Sea, or Amalek, or Mamzerut, or gay marriage, or any number of places where a particularistic Jewish God, as we have understood the notion, has played out through the tradition, is problematical? How do we square that? And then also the opposite side, when you say something like, for Heschel, God is a God who cares, there is a, even if it's metaphoric, there is a sort of literalism there, right? It's not just the notion of wonder versus expediency, but something that, as it were, has some degree of existence that I also oppositely struggle with. And it's unfair at the very end, but if you want
yeah,
to...
So I think, Nigel, the questions that you're asking, I think in a way... And they're both obviously like good and important questions. They, in a way, point to the problem I think one always has in engaging a theologian on a particular question, which is, but wait, how does that question tie into his larger theology and interpretation of the Jewish tradition as a whole? Which are important questions, and in the way I presented Heschel, I'm begging those questions, right? Because I'm trying to situate him that way. Now, I think to answer that question fully, we have to spend time thinking about Heschel's notion of revelation and what is learned through revelation. We'd have to think about his notion of interpretation and what authority people have to interpret, for lack of a better term, resistantly, texts that are troubling, violent, or what he calls harsh passages. All those questions are, you know, very much on the table. It happens to be, and I'll say this as a kind of almost throwaway for what could be in itself like a huge discussion, Heschel is deeply committed to the view that the God of the Hebrew Bible is profoundly universalistic. As he puts it at one point, the prophets are the first universal men. The prophets, he says, are the first people who have a sense of what it means to talk about humanity as a whole and not just some culture or people. I think what's complicated there, and this is really like veering off into a kind of complex question of intellectual history, I think that a lot of the things that Heschel finds in the prophets and the Tanakh are in fact there, but it took the Enlightenment for him and many other people to see them there, which is why his critique of modernity should be a little more modest than it is. Right? In other words, I think it's true, right, that the claim of the Hebrew Bible is a claim about a God who creates human beings in the image of God and not Jews in the image of God, and who creates the earth primordially and not the land of Israel primordially, who sanctifies time primordially, right? There's a lot of like deeply what my teacher John Levinson calls the universal horizon of biblical particularism, right? There's a universal horizon to biblical particularism. But the fact is that large parts of the history of Judaism didn't choose to see those things. I mean, on Thursday afternoon in the yeshiva, I'm going to be teaching some Hasidic texts about Hanukkah. The Hasidic tradition is a good example of this, right? Basically, every time you think you're going to get into a discussion about humanness, lo and behold, you find that human being really means Jew. Right? And so on the one hand, you have this incredibly powerful kind of spiritual vision of a divine who is engaged with human beings, of human beings who really matter, who have profound impact on this world and the upper world, however you understand what that means. And at the same time, you have this kind of this persistent emergence of really deep ugliness. Now, can you explain it socioculturally about, you know, where it comes from and Jews taking revenge through their texts? Sure you can. Is that an excuse for it? I don't think so, personally. And I think Heschel, in many ways, is committed to seeing the Jewish tradition. The truth of the Jewish tradition, Heschel would claim, is the God who loves all of humanity and who beckons every human being into a relationship. I don't think he's aware of how modern inflected that is. Or if he is, he's decided in good traditional form that he ought not draw attention to that, because that makes it less likely to be accepted. Because the way to sell an idea into the Jewish tradition is not to say, "Hi, look at me, here's a radical innovation." Right? As I have said to almost every class in Jewish thought I have ever taught, rather what you do is, "What do you want from me? It's the Rambam." By the way, in this case, he's right. Right? Because the Rambam is the great voice of, on this level, universalism. So, there's a lot to say there. And yes, the God that he's talking about is a real God. Is transubjectively real, as he puts it. Is the Ribono Shel Olam. Is the creator of the world. Whether it's possible for those who struggle with that idea to take pieces of Heschel and use them? Sure, I suppose it is. Although for him, that's the first and the last. Right? You know, the first and the last is that we're talking about a God. Not pantheism, not monism, not even panentheism, but like God. I mean, I'm being rhetorical in a Heschel mode, right? I mean, I sometimes imagine Kaplan saying to Heschel, "What do you mean, God? What do you mean by that word? And Heschel's saying, what do you mean? What do I mean? I mean God, God. I mean like a transcendent someone who has at least as much consciousness as I do, else it's not worth worshiping. What do you mean? So, you know, is that helpful? For some people, it's very helpful. In our contemporary cultural idiom, it's very important for that voice to reemerge unapologetically. But then those who struggle with that language to also figure out how to make sense of texts and traditions that are so fundamentally married to that. Right? I mean, yeah, okay, I'll stop. Okay. Thank you all very much.